Okay, so this is the second episode of the podcast, The Loopcast, where we talk to national security folks, young national security folks in D.C. on certain national on issues that are sort of in play and being talked about. I have Adam Alkus and Alexander Olesker here, and we're talking about information security, cyber warfare, cyber crime, stuff like that, and its sort of effect on law enforcement, society, and IR. So, here we go. So, to begin with, guys, how do we define cyber? Because it seems like, you know, we have cyber crime, we have cyber warfare, and then, you know, you have these other issues where that are neither crime, neither warfare, and more social, political, and legal. And sort of, you know, as an analyst and as a policymaker, you really can't, there's a difficulty in sort of separating out these ideas. So how do we define, if there can be a definition?
I think that's a pretty hard thing to go off, because right now there's actually a very big lack of consensus as to how to define it, and I'm not even completely sure myself, because I've seen a lot of competing and different explanations. But if I were to say that there's that one that gets probably to the closest, it's the one that Dan Keel, formerly of the National Defense University, you know, put it in his book on cyberpower, which is a group of interconnected electronic and digital networks. And I would have to repeat to you I don't know the full definition offhand, but I would advise anyone who's interested in it to buy that book and read up on his chapter in which he talks about the dynamics of it. I think the key thing, though, which is something that Sam Lyles on Twitter, S. Salil, if you're looking for, is repeated a lot, is that don't confuse cyberspace with just purely the internet. Don't also confuse cyberspace with just purely the network. There's an aspect of cognition, control, and communication that can also be applied to the telegraphic era. And to some extent, computer is another form of it, but at the same time, you can't really quite reduce it quite to that, particularly since our forms of computing itself are rarely stable. One thing that Sam has pointed out is that if of all cyber is just the network, what do you say about biological computing, which might come along over the next 20 years? If you want to have a good definition, it has to be one that'll survive changes in the hardware.
Yeah, I would agree with Adam on that, and for that reason, I really try to think about things in terms of information security and information crime, because I've found more or less that there's a lot of similarity between you know, penetrating networks in the sense of computer networks or human networks, and you know, counterfeiting credentials. The means are different, but there's a lot of similarity between doing that in meat space, as they say, in cyberspace. So
it's an old cyberpunk term too, in Neuromancer, like William Gibson, like the lady, like one of the key characters characterizes like non-cyber as like bags of bone or meat, like really almost derisively. Like it's like to be, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's actually, it's a good point, because Adam and I actually have collaborated to talk about how works like Neuromancer have largely shaped the way that we look at cyber for better and for worse, because of more or less the definition problem and all of the associated thinking, the visualization, and all of that. A lot of that was developed through popular imagination and through works like that, as much as it's come from doctrine.
And I think that the other part about Keel's definition is that he talks about these integrated electronic and analog and digital networks that are all networks that are also a subset of an overall information domain, and that's something fairly important when thinking about sources of compromise, in the sense of that. I recently wrote up a case study of Moonlight Maze, which is one of the formative cybersecurity incidents. like for an upcoming volume. And one of the interesting things that struck me on looking through the interviews with senior leaders in the DoD information security space was talking about how one of the sources of compromise was the civilian national security research labs, which had a much more open culture than necessarily that of the military and government. And that was a source of compromise, for getting into the military and government space, even if, you know, even if that was not necessarily completely a part of that space. It was more, but and all, there's also social engineering, which is very prominent and probably the most common way of compromise, in the sense of if you click on spear phishing link and someone puts malware into your computer, right, what they're exploiting is the overall information domain and social networks you're connected,
right,
to.
Right.
So I mean, that brings up a whole series of questions and ideas, but I mean, it seems like when we line up the information space, you know, and then we, you know, along with the digital and then, you know, electronic, I mean, it just seems like, how do you begin to assign specific definitions, particularly legal definitions? I mean, how do you, as a lawmaker or a somebody who is entrusted to enforce the law, what do you do, or can you do anything? Can you define these, you know, facets legally?
So that has, I think that's much more of a, that was much more of a problem in the past than it is now. So, you know, one of the famous case studies, you know, around the whole Cuckoo's Egg case, where it was, you know, it turned out a hacker paid by the KGB was sort of traipsing about our networks, starting in, you know, academic networks and using that to get on military networks, and it was all written in Cliff Stoll's pretty classic book, The Cuckoo's Egg. You know, there are a lot of organizations like the FBI that just wouldn't take the case, because how do you even define damages caused by hacking? They
exactly.
said, hey, kid, if it's less than $1 million, eventually they were able to agree on $500,000, but, you know, that still doesn't mean much, then we're not going to look into it because we're only interested in major thefts. We're the FBI. Well, nothing was taken. It was copied. It was stolen in that sense. But, you know, how do you put a dollar value on secrets or information or privacy? Or, you know, are you destroying anything? All of that. That was quite tricky, but lately, a lot of people don't realize that there begin to be more and more, there's more and more of a legal precedent, and a lot of the laws do exist and are on the books. There's some tricks about, you know, making things work across national boundaries, and there are a few things we're still figuring out. But I think that increasingly there is growing to be a body of legal work and legal precedent on cyber.
So what do you exactly you prosecute? It seems like we have a very famous case recently of social engineering, where somebody, I think it's Matthew Ho, he writes for Wired, where somebody basically was able to get into his Apple account, his Amazon account, mm-hmm. and a whole bunch of like personal accounts. And you know, in the article that where he sort of documents what has happened to him, nobody brute forced their way through a password, and nobody was able to hack his password, but rather they used social mechanisms. They called Apple and said, you know, we're able to give his name and his address and say, can I reset my password? And they resetted his password. So I'm curious, does social hacking and social engineering fall into a legal category, or is it, or is the crux of the law seems to be, you know, missing information or, as you said, damages? I mean, is there, can we prosecute social hacking? Or is that more, we have to wait until the crime is committed? Or, you know, an actual more traditional form of crime?
So back in the day, again, going back to the 80s, they had to fall on all of these, you know, little technicalities. Like, if you were using a network illegally, they would prosecute you for stolen time via telephone charges, you know, stupid things like that. And, you know, that's sort of one of the old tricks of law enforcement, is some stupid laws are easier to enforce than others.
Right.
You know, like, you know, like loitering for open-air drug markets. You know, you don't have to find drugs to convince someone, to convict someone of loitering. You just, then you pick them up for loitering and they happen to have drugs, you know. But the with things like that, it's tricky, and that's one of the reasons I do like to think of it somewhat holistically as information. And I remember a thought-provoking question that was raised by, actually, I think, Matt DeVoe's daughter. You know, very young. Matt DeVoe is an important figure in information security, and he's been at this for a long time. He was also the guy behind the Terrorism Research Center. He had been telling his daughter about cybersecurity, and I think at the dinner table she asked, "Well, Daddy, is it hacking if someone can just guess the password?"
Oh.
And he didn't know. He took it to Facebook, which is where I found out about this. And that is a good question. I think in a large way it is. And sort of the definition of hacking that I'm working with is, you know, using the, basically co-opting systems, using the functions of a system to make them do what you want, which you can do with any, with social systems. You know, you can, that's where a lot of, I kind of like the whole, like, life hacking movement, because that's, it's actually very similar to computer hacking. But is it a crime? It is a crime to, for example, illegally access networks.
Right.
But even
like guessing a password requires, as you said, like, it requires co-opting somebody's social system. Like, you need to know the person, like, you know, what are their most common used passwords? What are the most common, you know, images, ideas in their life?
What are the default passwords? Maybe they didn't change the default passwords. That remains and has long been one of the most popular ways to get on a network is, you know, putting in username, system, password, admin. Yeah, which is just what comes out of the box on some systems and things like that, or like guest, password, guest. There is also some analog here with MeetSpace, with the question of privacy, for example. Right. You know, when you're, what's snooping and what's privacy, and then it's based on reasonable expectations of privacy. And, you know, it's okay to listen in on a conversation that's happening in the same room. It's not okay if they close the door.
Oh.
You know, things like that. What is a, quote, reasonable expectation of privacy? So, you know, it's not okay to snoop through someone's paper, but it's okay to see the paper that they left on their desk. So things like that. And those are legal issues that we've been combating sort of for a while, and I'm sure that the same debate goes on into cyberspace, but it's not necessarily a new one.
It's interesting too that the phrase hacking actually comes from the series of practical jokes that went on that are a long tradition at MIT, in the sense of, and that long before, in a sense, the idea of computer hackers came to the fore, it was a very long tradition at MIT to do a long series of, at times, very disruptive practical jokes. And that gets into some of the hacking is also used there as to refer to just beneficial modifications to make things better, which gets into some of the other tricky territory in the sense of that hacking is not a uniform phenomenon.
It's not negative.
I mean, a lot of hackers are people who are, as Anonymous said, after the lulls. That's actually the whole reason why that person you mentioned who worked at Wired got hacked. It's just someone wanted to screw with his Twitter account.
And all they knew about him, which is interesting and telling, is that he had a 3-letter Twitter account. Which are very rare, obviously, at this point, because you had to be a very early adopter to get your, like, 3-level. I think his was, like, MAT or something. Right? Yeah. And that was all they didn't know. They didn't even know, they claimed, that he worked at Wired. So it really was, again, just the lulls.
To mess with him.
And there are also people who hack primarily to expose security flaws, either to sell them commercially to companies or out of sort of a mistaken idea that by doing so they're performing a social good, even if it's incredibly disruptive.
Now, wasn't there's a case that has, I think it's been resolved, where somebody was brought to federal court and they were charged with illegally accessing networks and another charge. But, like, based on what you just mentioned, like, he was doing a very standard activity, which is finding exploits in private companies, you know, their websites, or their work, but he made the mistake of saying it rather loudly. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if within a hacking community or within any digital community, is there a sort of sense of social discipline, what you can and cannot do, and that's sort of managed by the law?
So, so part of it is a organizational culture sort of thing, right? Because, you know, major companies rely on people finding holes in their security. And the question is, you know, how do they bring that to light and how is it done? And usually bigger companies and smarter companies, when I hear about the ones that really, where there are millions and billions of dollars depending on these systems, like Oracle and SAP and Microsoft, they might just straight up thank the guys, the white hats, who discover this stuff and let them know. Sometimes they would let them know first and let them patch it or put it up on their blog. But, you know, I guess some of it would be prosecutable because, you know, you don't know it works until you try it, right? So, and I've seen that dealt with a sort of, I guess right now it's just a judgment call. There was a recent fairly major, well, actually in some ways fairly minor, but very visible hack of a international social networking site that ended up being published in totally, totally legal, visible journals because the people in the journals had decided that it wasn't a harmful hack, it was just interesting, and it will get it'll get the companies running these social networking sites to sort of tighten the screws a little bit and not let something damaging through. So there is some judgment call on this. I've heard of some research companies sort of walking the line with that and having to deal with a few headaches with this. But overall, I think we need folks like that, the security researchers, to poke and prod around.
Now, I'm curious now to sort of switch gears, but rather, how do we perceive this in the political space? It seems, you know, a big thing on Twitter is that, you know, somebody will have a drone article, you know, and suddenly it's, you know, robots taking over the world, you know.
And drones.
Drones, right, in this very exaggerated manner. But I think, you know, in the digital space, you know, we have a lot of, you know, we were talking about sort of these automated bots that work on Wall Street, these high volume traders that nobody talks about, you mm-hmm. know, but they have the capability. You know, there was the flash crash in 2010 where the market lost 10% of its value in 5 minutes and then bounced back up. But I'm curious about, you know, how does the political space view issues of cybersecurity, info security? I mean, do you think it's in a sort of exaggerated manner? I mean, it seems we hyper-focus on drones when, you know, most of our critical economic and medical infrastructure is basically underwritten by bots.
My very simple sort of opinion on this is that the whole, quote, cyber war thing massively overplayed. Cyber espionage is getting roughly the attention it deserves, and cyber crime is not getting enough attention and is very much underplayed.
I also think to some extent that people expect higher standards about cyber-related things than they do with others, and it can be sometimes very odd, and since the idea of the attribution question, and it's made to be a very big thing, but at the same time, there are fundamental attribution questions about major aspects of international affairs that are still yet to be answered, particularly the DC bombing plot with the, like, was the person that was arrested really connected with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps at all, or the apartment bombings in Russia that triggered the Second Chechen War, which we are still kind of arguing about whether or not who committed them, and to some extent, or in a sense, in the field of cybercrime, people will demand. People will say that cybercrime is problem solving petty crime, but at the same time, petty crime of all kinds in general tends to be massively unsolved.
Now, do you think like the attention that we spend like on drones versus, you know, cyber, you know, the tools and the weapons of cyber, has Do you think it has anything to do with the idea that what's being used is not flashy? That, you know, a denial of service attack on, you know, a company's servers or defacing somebody's website isn't as flashy as, you know, a Reaper drone flying over Afghanistan or an atomic weapon? I mean, do you think that that sort of changes the nature of the political and legal debate? We'll get to legal, but...
I actually think there are massive parallels in the sort of... the way that the two issues are getting attention, because parts of cyber really are getting a fairly large amount of attention. The war part, the whole, like, what if people knock off the electric grid and all of that, you know, the quote sexy, you know, parts of it are definitely getting a lot of attention. And the parallels I see with drones is that people are really looking at the implements versus, you know, the policy behind them. And as we all like to sort of point out, it's not the fact that the drone is doing the bombing that we should be discussing. It's the bombing. Right. You know, who was hit? Was that a good move? What are the ramifications? Was the intelligence good? All of that. So, you know, for example, you know, a Chinese cyber attack on that, you know, or that steals information from U.S. networks wouldn't be important because it's cyber. It's important because it's espionage.
Right.
Just so that's sort of my take on it. And I think, you know, you do see a lot of aspects like cybercrime somewhat get underplayed. In corporate environments, they're getting more play just because there's such a drain of money.
So I'm
I think that people also underrate cyber power as a phenomenon, in the sense that people love to focus on cyber attacks and infiltration and hacking. But again, one of the really great things about the NDU volume was that they looked at how cyber power, in the sense of computer networks, communication, ant communication, guidance systems, command and control, all play a role in projecting U.S. power worldwide, that are really far more important at the end of the day than anything having to do with Stuxnet. And you can see that in the way that the Russians and the Chinese write about information power related to the U.S. They never really talk about it in terms of viruses. What they talk about is the Russian term, the reconnaissance strike complex, as in the integrated networks and systems that enable the U.S. to project precision power across the globe. And that's the sense of that a cyber attack has yet to kill anyone, but precision-guided weapons wielded by the U.S. have destroyed armies.
That makes sense. Now, I'm curious, like, largely in the popular sort of conception is that we focus on computers. Now, I don't really use a computer that much. In fact, my main method of communication, tweeting, annoying loved ones, and to a degree, you know, other stuff like banking, emails, is done through my cell phone, through the mobile phone. Now, I'm curious, for cyber, like, how much do we include mobile devices? And whether, I mean, mobile devices also add a sort of interesting element to it, because not only are you worried about network security, but now you're worried about device security and devices that are very much widespread, you know, Android, you know, operating system, the Apple operating system, you know, you have these programs, you know, these operating systems that are very much, you can just go down to the phone store, buy a Nexus 4G, and suddenly you have, you know, a tool to examine and be able to figure out what's the best way to put malware. So I'm curious, you know, how do we include the mobile element, and should we, and how much, you know, do we do so?
I really think it should be, in a lot of ways, right there in the heart of the discussion, because you can't, just like you mentioned, right, you can't really separate it out from information security and computer security anymore, because most corporations now have, you know, people bringing in their personal devices. Yep. And they're, or rather, I should say organizations, because I can often even include government organizations into this. Basically, these devices become dual use, personal and work related, and accessing, you know, work networks, taking in work information. So they are, you know, they're not just playthings anymore. Just like you mentioned, we do a lot of things through our mobile devices, and I'd include tablets, I'd even include laptops. But with a lot of those, tablets and smartphones, we're just years behind in both our paradigm and our security technology with those. And you can do some amazing things with hacked mobile devices. I'm not even talking about stolen mobile devices, which is, which is obvious there, but they're,
jailbreaking is common. Like, it's, technically that's hacking your iPhone, yet you if you Google jailbreak your iPhone, there's forums, literally you have anybody who uses an iPhone as a potential script kitty,
Right. And while you can do a lot of awesome things, if you jailbreak your device, you also make it much more open to a lot of attacks, because by jailbreaking, you basically, well, I won't go too much into this, but, once you have access, you basically bypass all the things, all the idiot controls that Apple has put in for all of us. And so with, it used to be, there's a company called Fixmo that, for example, grew out of a cooperative agreement with the NSA. The NSA noticed that even back in the BlackBerry days, smartphones, I guess in a lot of places the BlackBerry days are still today, but right. Within the government, but still, even before we were talking iPhones, if you got access to someone's work BlackBerry, that could be disastrous. Right. Aside from just reading emails, you might be now with the GPS stuff. You could be tracking someone. I've heard corporate accounts of once you have a jailbroken phone or a rooted phone, you can turn on the microphone to record meetings. I've heard of that happening to companies.
Now I'm curious, because who's responsible for security on the device? Because you have network providers, so you have Sprint, Verizon, AT&T, the big three, and then you have Cricket and these little dudes. Smaller companies, more regional. Then you have the device, so Apple, Google. Google makes Android, right? Yeah. But who in this system is ultimately responsible? Like, the individual, maybe, but who's responsible for security in this case? I mean, where does the liability lay? Is it ultimately with the individual, or is it with the company who makes the phone, or with the network provider?
Well, look at the debates we're having in Congress right now. We haven't even figured that out with regular computer security, right? Is it, if anyone's, is it the government? Is it law enforcement? Is it us? Is it corporations taking care of themselves? We don't even know that at, with regular computer security, and I think that mobile devices would even add another level of complexity to that question, because some are provided by the employer, some are personal devices, some people have both personal devices and, employer-provided devices on the networks. I think that's a very difficult question that we're struggling with information security all the way through, in the way that we're not with physical security, because we've decided that if someone lobs a missile at you, that you don't, the Department of Defense protects you, but if even if a foreign government, let's say, infects your network with some spyware, we have not decided exactly whose bailiwick that is.
Yeah, and it'll only get worse as the Internet of Things includes that more and more everyday items in a household or corporation become part of cyberspace. And it also goes to the difficulties, again, we have with defining the term, in the sense of how meaningful is a computer or even necessarily an internet-based definition of cyberspace when you have all kinds of devices or systems that are connected to various networks, or even the compromise of in the compromise of systems that are completely air-gapped. And what we're really seeing with kind of the Internet of Things, like a ubiquitous digital infrastructure, is in a sense the conquering of everyday life by forms of cyberspace.
And there have been discussions of hacks of insulin pumps.
Oh my God.
For diabetics, there's discussion, hacks of, it's been proven that you can hack braking systems on cars, because those are all computerized.
Which brings up a really interesting question, Oh, you're talking about basic stuff of safety, like your insulin pump, your brakes. I don't know, there was a heart monitor that I remember reading that you were able, you could, you know, you had a basically an implant in your heart and, you know, an external unit. And if you wanted to, the guy really wanted, the case cropped up because the guy wanted more data. And he was afraid that, like, the company that was handling his data wasn't doing it in a way that he wanted to because he couldn't access it, or I forget the specific argument, but it seems like that as technology permeates more, that really these issues of safety and the issues of, you know, an individual, you know, you're going to have to really emphasize personal security through increased attention to digital systems. I mean, do you think that's more paranoia on my part? That, I mean,
paranoia is a strong word, but I do think that there is a lot of risk management that goes into this, just as anything, right? So, for example, being able to hack insulin pumps might be new or something in the future, but just physically meddling with someone's insulin pump has always been a thing. And you're thinking, you know, oh, what a jerk, who would do that, right? But who would hack an insulin pump? So, you know, I think one great, just as with anything, there are risks associated with things, and you need risk management, and maybe there are new attack vectors, both through cyber, but who knows, just through all sorts of means that we have to think about. But, you know, in some ways, online banking, for example, carries certain threats, and mobile banking carries certain threats, but so does using the ATM at night. And that's all true. Of those things you have to think about and weigh and let them inform your actions.
And there are kind of distinct differences in the sense of, but they're still at the heart, like still at the heart of it, reducible to other older factors. For example, espionage in the sense of the sheer volume of data that can be exfiltrated through through various hacking is perhaps greater on a scale, and that could be achieved even by someone like Kim Philby. But at the same time, it's also the question of the difference between the two is that if you're just taking large amounts of data through various automated exfiltration mechanisms, it still doesn't necessarily give you the kind of data which you want. The difference, Kim Philby was embedded within organizations and knew precisely what to look for, which comes to the thing I think a lot of people underrate when they talk about cyber threats is that the higher the level of damage you want to do, the increased level of target intelligence that's necessary, not only about the nature of the system, but also how the system's relationship with the users and the organizational context it's embedded in.
You make a really good point, like the idea that you could potentially like farm a lot of like huge amounts of data. Now I'm curious, like, I mean, the way I'm thinking of, like, in a counterintelligence measure, what would be just cut yourself off from the internet. You know, we saw this in Iran with its nuclear program, where they're able to, you know, set away key systems, just basically not be connected to any sort of internet. Or even more recently in Syria, where basically in order to manage, you know, the rebels, their communication strategy, they just cut the internet off for 2-3 days at a time, do what they need to, and so forth and so on. I mean, as an intelligence system, how much can we rely on, you know, digital means before we have to, you know, put a dude in the room or put a lady in a room or some sort of creature with a camera? I mean, it just seems, you know, that there's real limits with, you know, being able to procure information digitally.
So, I mean, what you're referring to is called air gapping, and that's what people often assume is the gold standard, and I've never heard of it ultimately working. And I've asked people, I've asked people who've been at this longer, I've asked some people who have been at this for 5 years, and they say, I've never heard of this ultimately working. And I asked people who've been at this for 15 years and 20 years, and they said, I've never heard of this ultimately working, because nothing ends up being perfectly air-gapped. And that's for a number of reasons. Some of them are technical. Interesting example was when drone cockpits got a virus here in the United States, if you remember that. And, right. You know, you're not connected to the internet on drone cockpits, so they're talking about, if this is impossible, these systems are air-gapped. Well, you can still transfer information by USB because that's the only way you can load massive maps quickly enough for drones. And what happened is someone had also used the same USB on their home computer while playing Farmville, and it was actually a Farmville-related virus that was that was a keylogger, and, you know, if it wasn't made for, getting the best virtual crops, it could have been, like, a huge espionage problem, but fortunately that was just, you know... Yeah,
now it's a common practice for red teamers that they just drop a that what they'll do is that they'll drop a USB stick in a parking lot of their target and just sort of wait and to see how long it'll take before someone will see a USB stick on the ground, pick it up, and say like, "Hey, I could use this," and plug it in. I mean, it's why the why you can't reduce cyberspace just being purely the internet is that. And that's you have a variety of communication and collaboration and cognitive means that can be used to compromise systems and
social, and
I think to some extent too that there's also trade-offs from isolation. One of the Julian Assange wrote a series of technical papers because he was a former hacker who before he got involved in WikiLeaks, in which he talked about. His goal was to cut off the Department of Defense's ability to make decisions by ruining the trust within DOD, and by thought that if I can make them so paranoid that they won't use the most profitable means of sharing information with each other, then they'll then their decision output will be suboptimal. And he called that as in like destroying the links between conspiracies in his own heavily anarchist language. And I mean, of course, DOD proved to be a lot more robust than an Australian hacker could take down, but at the same time, the same general principle applies that in order to get things done, you need some measure of connectivity, and even clandestine covert networks, as Alex and our friend Robert Caruso can attest, have a very complicated means of information sharing. There's no kind of network of any sort that can remain completely autistic,
right.
And any kind of degree of connection has some degree of risk.
And, you know, just to build off that and a past point that Adam made, so let's say Adam is working at, you know, the super secret SSD, the Secret Squirrel Department, you know, and there are some networks that the Secret Squirrel Department is using that I, you know... In the anti-secret squirrel department, want to know the ASSD, want to know the information on, and you know, but they are air gapped, and let's say they don't ever have maintenance people go on to work on them, and they've you know put super glue in their USB drones, you know, all that. Just
is that
there's
really
nothing
common practice.
That is common practice, or whatever drone? Polymer, so that you can't even accidentally. But anyhow.
Wow.
Yeah, and in very paranoid places, that is how it, I've heard, is done.
Right.
But, you know, let's say Adam's on this network and I really want to know the information there, you know, and I just, they've been really good about their air gapping and I just can't come up with a good way. I could give Adam $20 and I could ask him what's on there, right? So there, I've essentially penetrated the network because the information isn't air gapped. There's no electronic... You know, transfer. They might even be in a Faraday cage, you know, all of that.
Wow.
You know, information's not coming in and out, but Adam's coming in and out, and Adam's a mode of transferring information. Yeah.
Awkward.
Yeah, we have to kind of move, like Dorothy Denning's book on computer security makes the useful point that that computers are not the only things that can contain and transport information.
Right.
And you can if you're developing a model of information warfare, you have to move along the idea that there are many different possible containers of information, each of which can be disrupted. Or compromised in certain ways, in large part because the idea of information predates computing.
Right. That was a good conversation, and I want to sort of switch gears to the creepier portion of the internet. Mostly,
is it 4chan?
Yeah, it's 4chan.
No, it's actually creepier than 4chan. Basically, what we do with the information, and so you know, the internet. These systems that we've been talking about produce, you know, pardon my, you know, language, a butt ton of data. So, and sort of the big thing that's coming up is big data, analytics, you know, how do we sort through, you know, this massive amount of data, whether it's, you know, DoD with pattern surveillance with drones, or, you know, using an algorithm to, you know, organize financial data, or even in its most creepy sort of fashion, you know, Facebook and Google Analytics. So I'm curious whether, you know, our generation, you know, what are the expectations of privacy? How do we manage these tools? Because, you know, for example, anecdotally, you know, for the company I used to work, you know, do a contract for this company, and, you know, they had developed a website and were curious in the patterns of usage of this website. You know, I thought the analytics program was going to be like Google, where it tells you, you know, what page you've landed on, how long you've spent time on that page, so forth and so on, maybe even IP address. No. These analytics were insane. The first data point was the time on which they landed on the page and the first action. And then you could use this program and sort of see, you know, where the person, you know, put their mouse cursor and sort of, you know, accessed, you know, forms and files, and generally really suss out, you know, how they went through this web page, this, you know, particular web page. And so,
click streams.
Right. And you could do this for thousands of people, and, you know, potentially even in the case of Facebook and Google Ads, millions, maybe billions. So I'm wondering, the first question I have is, you know, what is the expectation of privacy? Like, clearly, you know, I didn't know the guy's name, I didn't know his, you know, his pedigree, but I did know a lot about, you know, how he, his company, and people were accessing, you know, this NGO's website. So what's the expectation of privacy here?
So this is a great question, but briefly, I just couldn't not mention this. You might have heard my phone vibrate a few seconds ago. I was just hit with a phishing attack.
Holy crap.
As we were doing this podcast, apparently someone on Facebook had been hacked and are now sending me what I can tell is clearly, you know, a malicious link for like a free iPad or whatever.
Yes.
So, you know, issues, you know, obviously I'm not going to click and follow this, but, you know, issues close to home.
A third of my followers have probably been spearfished over the last couple of months, and they keep sending me a DM that says, look at what you've been doing on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, that's just, I mean, on one hand, that's a pretty dumb fish, but at the same time, I mean, given how many people post embarrassing photos on Facebook, it's like a motive for clicking it.
But to the question of privacy, I think that's a great question. And it was, again, Sam Lyles who really got me thinking about the fact that privacy, you know, people often talk about privacy versus security, but privacy is a part of security,
mm-hmm.
especially for us ordinary folks, not at the fictional Secret Squirrel directive, you know, who, for, you know, one of the worst things that can happen to me would be a violation of my privacy. That would be very troubling to me.
But what are we defining as privacy? Because it seems like Google Analytics, for example, can potentially log your IP address. Like when you access this blog, and they have
potentially, they totally do. But like, yeah.
No, I mean, they also have a live feature. So, like for, you know, CSIP, we use Google Analytics, and I think it tells me when I put a blog post up when the person accesses that link and what city. So I can literally see that somebody's accessing it from New York. And it just seems like, I don't know who's doing the accessing, but rather I know their geolocation. And I know all this, you know, I mean, what is the expectation of, like?
So you can do, the disclaimer is you can do a massive amount of good with this information. A lot of people do. But right now what we're dealing with is almost, again, a classic question of in meat space, they would call sensitive but not classified information. When they tried to come up with that classification, that was information that on its own might not be terribly important. So, again, an example that Cliff Stoll used for the physical world is if you hear that a contractor is buying a bunch of titanium, that is not classified. That's just business stuff. If you hear that a contractor is developing a new airplane, that's not classified. That's just business stuff. If you have those pieces of information together, you can figure out that they're building titanium airplanes, which means that they're supersonic airplanes, and now you're starting to find out about, you know, our Air Force and research and development there and what the future capabilities are there, and that is information that should be classified. So you're dealing with a lot of sensitive but not classified information.
It's the problem of promulgation, that you have point A, point B, they might not be related, but then you look at point C and suddenly,
right,
you know, you have titanium plane designs, and you look at, you know, you sort of wander to point C and you say, oh, you know, subsonic, supersonic planes. Now, I mean, that's my issue with sort of big data, is that, like, sort of, you know, if with all these really public data sets, is that suddenly, you know, you have A, you have B, you know, C, you know, isn't that large of a cognitive leap anymore.
Right. And I also worry to some extent that kind of the idea of the quantified self is going to enable things that I think that people may not be ready for. I mean, one of the joys of working at a Crucial Point LLC, which I still write for, and Alex used to be at.
I do still write there.
Yeah, he's still up on there. But was reading through McKinsey reports about big data, and one of the examples I saw was the idea of a car that will be able to produce a quantitative measure of your driving skills. It's always recording, and then your car insurance rate is adjusted in real time based on the data that an insurance company can get
that.
About. Then you can expand that to many other areas too, and I think that on one hand you're within a space of that, yes, your driving behavior should affect your insurance claims. But at the same time, the question is the degree of how much invasiveness are we willing to grant companies who have control over aspects of our lives. I mean, hell, even the rap star Rick Ross is worried about this when he raps about the feds listening to his conversation through his OnStar.
Right. And this again brings up the question of reasonable expectation of privacy, which, you know, more or less, it seems like a lot of the definitions that we're dealing with here are like obscenity, we'll know it when we see it. So there are, you know, I've seen some amazing things be done with big data analytics, and, you know, people could find out, well, I mean, look at what Amazon can do in their recommendation engines.
Netflix.
And Netflix. And Netflix is a great example, actually. I'm glad you brought that up, because in Netflix, some students, I think in a computer science PhD program, entered and then wrote a paper about this contest that Netflix would regularly do for designing better recommendation algorithms. And in their solution was, instead of coming up with a better algorithm, they just pulled more data. And they were able to prove, essentially, like in a scientific proof, that more data beats better algorithms all the time. And that's what they found, that just throwing more information and then just having big data analytics sort of suss it out will build better recommendations than even the most clever algorithms. And you see this all over the place. Cancer research, interestingly enough, using machine learning and sort of big data analytics for basically microscopic photographs of cells, they were able to create a program that is better than a lot of the doctors and scientists whose job it is to look at biopsies and identifying cancer, because they looked at everything and there are factors that we scientifically did not know were linked, in this case to breast cancer, that turned out to be good predictors. So there's a lot of... What I'm trying to say is you can get a very good picture of someone by connecting all these tiny useless pieces of information, and that brings up the question of, you know, reasonable expectations of privacy, right? So it's not, you know, you can't say that you have a reasonable expectation, for example, to the privacy of, you know,
your meth lab.
Well, no, that's a slightly different question, but we're bringing up a lot of issues here. But, you know, is when Safeway monitors more or less what I buy with my Safeway card to decide what coupons I get, that's fine. That doesn't violate my reasonable expectation of privacy. But if they linked up with, you know, with 100 other you know, stores in the area to see where I go during the day and to trace my steps, that would be not okay. And it's almost the question of, again, you know, we've decided that a conversation that you can hear in a room is not, you know, listening in does not violate privacy. Behind a window, it does violate privacy, but what if you can lip read?
And I think the question, too, is also that, to some extent, there's a big question I've been seeing in, like, in journals, I mean, in journals such as MIT's survey of information, that about whether the current advertising supported business model that supports a lot of Web 2.0 sites can be sustained. And the question, and some people are saying that Facebook should copy Google in the sense that Google is not necessarily purely just a search engine. It's also an advanced analytics engine based around the data that you put in. And I think to some extent there's a question that sites that may be hurting for cash may try to turn themselves into big data engines in which they try to mine everything you put into it into a profile for various entities that are willing to pay for them.
But Facebook already does that, and
it could be a lot worse, is what I'm saying.
True. But I mean, like, for instance, we use CSEP, the organization that I started, is that we used to use Facebook Analytics, but the problem was that the people we were pulling in to follow our organization were basically just random people, because like Facebook, like, just randomly advertises like based on your city preferences. So I'm curious that when we start moving from, you know, if we combine the Facebook model of just pushing out advertisements in a region versus the specific model of Amazon and Netflix, like, what do we, I mean, is there an expectation of privacy there? Like, if, you know, if I go to Facebook right now and suddenly it's advertising for podcast software, knowing that my Facebook status is recording podcast, I mean, can we still make a argument for privacy, or is it, should I just not use Facebook? I mean, it seems like social media, sub point, is that social media has sort of changed, like, it really has altered. And this is something really interesting to get at, is that it has altered our way, what we tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially in terms of just, you know, scanning and, you know, the whoever is hosting the service, Facebook, Google, you know, it has increased our social toleration.
And I think that that's kind of probably, I mean, a function, too, of the trade-offs involved in... The trade-offs involved in living in a modern and connected world,
right,
and not being on those networks. And there are actually economic costs and also social capital costs to not being around. And I mean, most people in D.C., if they want to find work, are being told to network more heavily, to get on Twitter, just to go to happy hours. And again, there are changing material circumstances in society that make people much more motivated to sign on to and be connected. And when they're not, they suffer. So I think that people, whether sort of consciously in the sense of, well, I'm going to be on LinkedIn even if there is some security risks involved, or I'm going to use Amazon because it's convenient even though there are security risks and privacy risks, or I'm going to go on Facebook because however creepy I find what the site is doing, at the same time there is a social benefit to me that involves being able to stay in touch with all of my friends. And this loops back into our discussion of information security, is that the internet was not designed for security. I mean most of the things we associate with information technology were designed primarily for convenience's sake. And convenience will really win out all over security if it's posed as a binary.
That makes sense. So I'm curious, then, moving sort of away from analytics and big data in a marketing sense and in a law enforcement. For instance, is law enforcement, like, is big data, does it help law enforcement or does it hinder it? In the sense, I'll use the example of, let's say you want to monitor a neighborhood in New York. right? So you have the choice between, I know this is very bimodal, but for the sake of conversation, you know, you have the choice between, you know, having uniforms patrol the streets, build ties with the population, or you have a drone, like, you know, an automated system that flies around above the neighborhood observing patterns. So I'm curious, in a law enforcement setting, is big data useful? Can it be useful? Or is law enforcement such a human intelligence-driven task? And I'm not talking at the federal level, I'm talking like at the city and at the county level. Is it such a, you know, human intelligence-driven task that maybe big data isn't as useful, or it's not something to consider?
I would say that it is extremely useful with a few buts. Right. One of the buts is that a lot of departments aren't anywhere near that level of technical sophistication
yeah.
right now.
Right.
You know, I will not mention the name right now, but as a younger man, I did some work with a big city department that had just begun digitizing their files a few years back.
Wow.
And we still mostly worked with paper files. This is one of the largest departments in the country. And, you know, if we talk about, you know, they're like, oh yeah, we've been really big on data. Now we enter crime statistics into a spreadsheet. Like, oh, geez, wow. Okay. Well, and that was like, yeah, we started doing that 2 years ago and we discovered all these interesting patterns. I'm like, holy crap. You know, so there's that consideration that's very real, but a few departments, LA is actually getting really good at this, is starting to use big data for law enforcement in some really helpful and beneficial ways that are really actually helping people quite a bit. But I don't think that it is in the slightest bit a counter for human intelligence. I think the both are most effective together because, you know, the example of the drone and the officer, right? They would do very different things because ideally, you know, at best, your perfect drone would monitor what goes on. The officer would be a part of that. It's very different what you can do as part of a network versus observing it. And, you know, in real life, there are a lot of other pragmatic differences, too. And even with big data, even if you're pulling in, even if you have all this information that you're pulling in, the most important part are the questions that you ask the information and how you ask them, and you need a person in the loop for that. And it's interesting that you've mentioned, you know, the officer walking around. Right now, the most useful thing that has been done, I guess my humble opinion with big data and law enforcement, is helping tell the officer where it'd be most useful for him to walk around, not just to observe crime, but just to interact with the community. And you know, it takes a lot of information to be able to do that somewhat predictively rather than reactively. Not like, well, you know, there was a shooting on this block last week, hang out there more actively. But to say, you know, it looks like something bad might happen here soon based on, you know, the pattern in shootings and burglaries. And by the way, there's an ATM right there and, you know, all that stuff. And that drives the human, but the human also drives that.
So I think that the tacit knowledge is something that's also important too to discuss. Is that tacit knowledge is experiential in scope, and it's not very easily expressed in sort of a form that can be readily assimilated by large data analysis. I think that that's changing, particularly as big data begins to be able to deal much more with rough and unstructured data. But at the same time, it's kind of the difference in a sense between, if you take a reasonably well-educated person who, let's say he reads every single field manual the Army puts out, but he still would not be able to lead an Army platoon because
right.
there are many experiential tasks and forms of knowledge that can only be disseminated through training and learning programs. And that's where that is kind of an area in which machines can be useful as well, but it's also something that, at least in terms of law enforcement, that will remain the province of the human. I think that, though, that there's been a data revolution ever since the 80s with Bratton's use of CompStat to be, and that, and the CompStat benefits not only the police department in showing where crime is aggregated, but also the people, in the sense that CompStat data is widely available. So if you're looking to kind of look at where do you want to live in New York, you see a great deal for an apartment, you can go up on CompStat and see if there, the crimes that were clustered there historically and so on.
So I'm curious, what does it do for prosecution then? So we know about the order part, but what about the law part? If somebody is arrested based on prediction, this prediction of a model. So let's just be super controversial. All right, you have a neighborhood high crime, you know, an officer, you know, is aware of the model and acts on the model and arrests, let's say, young black guy, young Arab dude, whatever, you know, and it, you know, and the fact that, you know, he just happens to have a weapon or drugs. So I'm curious that if the more we get into big data and the more we get into sort of this fine line of the current and the predictive, what happens to prosecution? I mean, you know, if the ultimate intention of law and order is to reduce crime and secure, you know, the public, you know, let me even be more controversial. What if you have like something like a Minority Report? No, is it the one?
Yeah,
with Tom
Cruise?
Yeah.
No, no, that's Minority Report. Yeah.
So I mean, if we have a system that has so much data and a solid algorithm, what happens to prosecution? Do we put faith, you know, in our model so much that it would lead, you know, to something like, you know, I know it's exaggerated, right, but I mean, for the sake of, you know, conversation and sort of example, to a Minority Report sort of.
I'll bring up several points here. One is, you know, and I understand it's an exaggerated example, but that's really not been how this stuff has been used. So when we use the term predictive, what it comes down to is more. Actually, one famous experiment in Santa Cruz that has become the model for a lot of this stuff is basically an academic used a slightly modified version of the of software and algorithms that predict aftershocks and earthquakes, because based on where past earthquakes have been and where the past aftershocks have been, you can sort of start predicting where the next one would be, and it turns out that property crimes follow a similar model. And that's actually not all surprising, because they use this in finance. They use the same algorithms, again, with probably slightly different multipliers. They use the same thing in epidemiology with the spread of diseases, and you can just sort of apply that same model to property crimes. And what it usually spits out are areas within, let's say, a patrol map. So CompStat, which has been used for years, says these are the hot spots because this is where crime was last week. This would say these are the hot spots because we think that there is a maybe only a 2% higher chance there'll be a burglary here. But you know what? I want you to pass this intersection not five times this hour when you're just driving around randomly, but seven. And that's what it comes down to. Now, what legally, that cannot be used as probable cause. You can't search anyone with that stuff. And in fact, anecdotally, what I've heard is a lot of the law enforcement big data uses actually crack down on things that we usually put down as profiling. because part of it is, and in some features this has been prominently advertised, is, you know, it's very easy, for example, to show with some big data technology that someone is stopping and frisking, you know, for example, young black men more than he should. More than makes sense. Also, you know, not based on in a much smarter way than, you know, there are two sides of this where, like, you know, yes, most of the people in a, you know, let's say entirely black or entirely Hispanic or entirely white neighborhood that'll be stopped and frisked will be whatever that neighborhood is made up of. A lot of people forget that, right? And but at the same time, when you have more information, you can really tell what is appropriate and what isn't in that way. Sort of helps sorts out a lot of the confounding information. But the other aspect there is that already, you know, you look at, I know in a lot of cities, I don't know if this is nationwide, but in a lot of cities, you basically feeling threatened can be grounds, for example, for a frisk. being in a neighborhood that you consider high crime can be threatening. So you have more or less more grounds to be threatened in a high crime neighborhood, and I don't know how much this would play out, and that's an interesting aspect that's worth exploring. You know, if your algorithms tell you that that crime is more likely in this area, you know, will you find this area more threatening? Will you be more likely to frisk people? And is that okay? I think that's something we have to grapple with.
What are the chances of feeding false information then? Like, it just seems like if I'm a savvy criminal, let's say a neighborhood kingpin, you know, I'm savvy enough to have sources in the police department who then tell me that they use this sort of modeling. What are the chances of not fooling, but messing with? Or even, like, you know, can somebody sort of mess with the data in any big data system to the point where you start getting false conclusions? Can somebody, you know, not in the sense of like bad data collection, what I'm trying to get at is more agency and right. intentional. Somebody doing counterintelligence, basically, and going through somebody, you know, treating the big data set as intelligence and sort of messing with it and sort of being able to, you know, veer attention away from specific things.
Well, it's hard. It can be done in some ways, but it's difficult, for example, with crime. So with, you can confuse, and there are a lot of programs that do this, you can confuse analytics. There are a lot of software suites out there that do this. Some of them are targeted at the intelligence community, but for example, one called Kapow is a crawler, so it'll pull information off of websites, and the problem is that a lot of websites, the bigger ones, will try to block bots, and there are ways that you can confuse that, basically by putting in so much information that it can't tell what's a bot and what isn't. The problem with crimes is that, and this is why it's typically done with property crimes, is that, you know, it would be a big effort to basically tell, you know, the quote-unquote soldiers, you know, the thugs on the ground, to go and burglarize houses that are harder to burglarize, for example, that are near the police station that don't have anything worth stealing just so that they can confuse the system. So if places are targeted, it's usually for a reason. You know,
right.
Poorly lit, poorly guarded, things worth stealing on a bus route, all of those things are important. It can be done. It's often difficult because the sort of what makes a lot of these big data analytics unique and interesting is that it picks up on so many small and practical factors, not the big showy ones, not the ones that you put on to display, that it makes it more difficult, but yes, possible.
I think, too, that, getting back to the minority report comparison is that, to some extent, I think that when people are like worry about that element of big data, they also don't really think about the distorting effect of human cognitive biases as well, in the sense mm-hmm. that when someone says, well, I think someone's gonna when in terms of racial profiling is just really, if you think about it, just a system of sorting and aggregation, but one that people unconsciously lapse into.
Right.
And if you replace sort of those unconscious but perhaps erroneous aggregation frameworks derived from prejudicial mental models with ones based on scientific processes, it's not perfect, but it's certainly better than a lot of the alternatives that ruled for hundreds of years in many small in the policing community.
Yeah, to give a specific example, there's a great software suite that recently came out called Street Cred, and it's used for warrant collections. Basically, it throws out, to give a very brief overview, for example, misdemeanor warrants, things like traffic tickets and things like that. A lot of places have millions of dollars worth of outstanding warrants, most of which are useless because you won't be able to collect that because it's 5 years old and that person has moved and, you know, all that stuff. So it sorts through this and it helps you figure out a route, and it uses all this information built on the tacit knowledge of officers that is sort of programmed into there. It's not allowed to look at race and gender, and it helps also very quickly generate statistics on things like whether the officer is unjustly targeting certain groups. However, it is, you know, a much more the quote profiling that it does, it ends up being much more accurate than, you know, race and gender-based profiling, while making it, you know, very difficult to put in race and gender-based profiling.
Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about tonight is where big data, security, and, you know, everything we've talked about sort of comes to crossroads, and that's social media. And when I say social media, I'm talking about Twitter, Facebook, and particularly if we can focus on its use. And, you know, around the question, how do we secure ourselves on social media while being able to sort of engage the medium? So, you know, if you remember a couple years back, you had a lady, Primoris Era, who was, I don't know what to call her, you know, the less polite word would be honeypot, sort of going out and trolling, you know, Intel people and DoD people for information. That's, you know, my understanding of it. But, you know, how do we as, you know, people who work in the field, who do, you know, analyst work or, you know, work at jobs that require, you know, a modicum of privacy, but yet requires that we engage on social media. How do we, you know, what do we do about security? What are practical things, you know, not, you know, connect only, you know, to Twitter through a VPN, you know, switch your ID, you know, whatever. I mean, like, what can we do as individuals and, you know, as people who want to engage in the conversation but not be trolled?
I think that one of the major things you can start with is that just pay attention to your social networks. And that is one of the method that Primoris Era used was the same one that was used by Robin Sage, which was a fictional identity created by a security researcher. It's that of adding people to social networks. And once you see sort of that, when if you're, let's say you're being prospectively added by one of those people on Facebook and you see that they have a lot of mutual friends, as you do, even though you've never met them in person. But the thing is that they've accumulated those mutual friends by adding people who are promiscuous in adding other people who add them. And by doing so, then they kind of ride off other people's social credibility. That's the same method that Jill Kelly used to get in tight in the Tampa culture, even though, as the newspaper investigation revealed, she was someone who had run up lots of debts and misrepresented a lot of things and could be potentially viewed as a security risk.
And just to add another example, before anyone was on Twitter and Facebook, Joe Pistone, aka Donnie Brasco, used exactly the same technique to infiltrate the mob. He used to hang out with a wise guy's cousin, who then got him hanging out with the wise guys, who then got him hanging out with the mob, and everyone, you know, sort of took that as, you know, he must be a good guy. And to tie it back to, you know, the ones and zeros, that's more or less the very common hacking technique of escalation of privilege, which is, you know, using less privileged accounts to get onto more privileged accounts until you are, you know, a super user, a system admin. You know, it's all, and I think the solution is sort of similar in that, and one of the reasons I like to hark about, you know, physical security being a lot like information security, you know, and information security being similar despite the medium, you know, just because you're on Twitter, don't do things you wouldn't do with your social network in real life. I mean,
Anthony, you know, Weiner.
Right. You know, you can't. Yeah, you're. Don't put the. You know, don't take those pictures out at a cocktail party. So don't put them up on Twitter. Similarly, you know, don't just because, you know, if you wouldn't be at a bar, you know, saying where your unit's deploying, don't put it up on Facebook. Similarly,
that could be totally taken another way.
Well done. But similarly, you know, don't do things with your password that you wouldn't do with your house keys.
That's true.
And you do have to be a little savvy about that. And you know, it's easy to talk about, but no one's, for example, read their Facebook privacy agreement. It's basically, if you read all the fine print everywhere, that'd literally be years of your life. So. So you do have to understand that when you're using any technology, you are incurring new risks along with new advantages, whether that's an ATM, whether that's a bicycle, a car, a computer, a social networking site. And I think it's just good practice in all those cases to educate yourself about what the risks involved are and make informed decisions about the risks you want to take.
And remember, it's always, I guess, a fundamentally human endeavor in the sense that people get fixated on the technology, but at the same time, as Alex said with the comparison of Pistone to the Robin Sage example, managing a social network in real life and online involves some of the same principles. It involves just being discretion as to how much you know about someone, how much you want them to know about your life and the kinds of people that you know. And these are things that I think people do intuitively every single day when they think about when they think about their social life and their privacy. It's just that they don't apply the same techniques to when they turn on the computer.
So my last question is, I think we're going to start doing this, when we have, national security, folks on, is what do you fear most? So I think what do you fear most, this week's what do you fear most will be when Google combines with Amazon or when Facebook combines with Twitter.
I think that Facebook combining with Twitter sort of happened already in the sense that Facebook took a lot of Twitter's best features. Your news feed kind of looks a lot more like Twitter these days. So I'd have to take the other one by default.
Yeah, I'm afraid of when they all four combine. I mean, Amazon has already become so good at taking my money, and I'm not even mad. They come up with things I want that I didn't even know I want, and they find like 12 different ways to tell me about it, and then they put in the one-click buy so that if I look at the product wrong, it arrives at my door the next day, So.
Just don't install any. If you can, don't just one. Just don't install anything that you can use to buy things through your phone. That's not gonna. Just not worry.
Oh my
god! Too late.
That's just not gonna work. There's dudes who will get drunk and then find that the next morning they woke up, they bought hundreds of dollars worth of things on Zynga products, Zombieville or whatever.
So I guess Amazon, because Amazon. Already taking so much of my money. If they find better ways to take more of my money, that's it. I'm doomed.
I'm pretty sure Amazon, I was just looking at their other stuff, not their books and not their DVDs. They sell everything. Like apparently you could instance information, you can buy server space and do all sorts of fascinating things. And so I'm gonna have to go with Google and Amazon.
Yeah, the Amazon Cloud is actually extremely awesome and has allowed it's almost sort of democratized supercomputing, and I see a lot of little research institutes basically doing little do-it-yourself supercomputers by renting a bunch of servers, running something like Hadoop, which lets you sort of do distributed computing on all of them, and suddenly, for about 15 minutes. Have a supercomputer. I think it's very awesome.
That's pretty scary. And it's all for $100.
Yeah, in that case, it's because they just cut the cost down. So, basically Google is horrifying, Amazon is horrifying. If they come together, we're just done.
It's going to be some sort of monster.
But it'll be a beautiful monster.
That's the moment when Skynet will become self-aware.
Right, yeah. Those are the two halves of Skynet's brain.
Drones and big data, they're coming.
Oh, man, I can't wait till the commentary. Oh, my God, big data. Ah, drones.
Well, thanks very much for hosting us.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you so much.